recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold. I sit down and interview people who know these crimes the best. Sometimes they're authors, sometimes law enforcement, and even family members of the victims. In the end, you'll see a darker side of Hoosier hospitality. Welcome back to the final episode, Infamous Indie's exclusive three-part series, Digging Up Dillinger, the truth behind the exhumation. In this part three, we continue our conversation with the Dillinger nephews and the former FBI agent Stuart Fillmore and local documentary filmmaker Scott Olmsted. If you have not listened to the first two parts, please go back, get caught up. It's important. This is exclusive content never before released, and the information in this podcast is not only new, but it's also helping solve the mystery that's nearly 86 years in the making. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you after the episode.
History Channel had just said
they didn't believe
Yeah, we think that the map is fake,
and they wanted to go in the direction of
right. And I was going to say, like I said, I said, "Hey, I'll do an affidavit. I'll do a deposition. Whatever."
And they didn't take that, even though
mainly because the executives were interested.
I don't think it mattered. They wanted to go that.
They
route.
Wanted to go that route of the imposter theory because they had had success with a previous show about the serial killer H.H. Holmes, and in that show they had actually done an exhumation, I think that was one of their highest rated shows.
The great great grandfather is on Infamous Indie with me. I mean great great grandson. He interviewed with me on Infamous Indie. So
right, he's
random connection.
Yeah, exactly.
Another coincidence.
It's funny how these things happen.
Yeah. So anyways,
they said that the more interesting angle was following
going
this,
that route.
Yeah, the imposter theory. And so I, thinking strictly as an investigator, I said, well, the quickest way actually that we can solve that mystery is let's just exhume the body. And we have a Dillinger, the closest living Dillinger relative on this project. We can test his DNA against the body in the grave. And I said, that will solve that right there.
Plus, I'm
still thinking we have a valid reason for this hunting for this buried loot.
Yeah.
And that's still where I'm thinking. And to me, this exhumation was just really an interesting idea, but hey, we can get that out of the way quickly. We can solve that. So that's when this saga started.
Yeah. So you went from trying to solve one Dillinger mystery to trying to solve both.
Yeah, a big one.
Yes.
A bigger one.
Yeah, right. So when that was brought to us, this is the direction they are wanting. This was a very hard decision.
When he first brought it up, I go, ain't no way.
Yeah.
And I got to thinking, I go, I've got the Dillinger, I got the deed to those plots. I have it. I mean, in the safe, I have that original, which I wasn't there, but actually Travis was with Paul, went to Crown Hill and showed him.
Meetings.
I've got the original deed to that plot.
They don't even have a copy of the deed.
Wow. So immediately you guys are like, this is great. This is gold.
Yeah.
And that's okay. When the History Channel made you switch, did you guys did the air go out with all you?
I have to admit, for me, it did a little bit.
A little bit.
Yeah, because it was so exciting about this map and the potential for the DNA testing on this ink that would have been from an indelible pencil, which is a licked pencil. The potential for saliva trapped in that ink, fingerprints, all those kind of investigative steps that, you know, you would want to film and show, and then tracking the leads of these cities marked on this map with the address book that we believe is Dillinger's.
There was two doctors' names in that address book.
Doing ground penetrating radar at Little Bohemia, and then there were several other sites that I felt were really good potential places to look.
And in them files, we actually found places that we didn't. There was a place by a lake in Texas.
Yeah,
that we never heard of that the Dillinger gang was at. There was, I was trying to think of the other. Haines City, Florida. Yeah. Actually, they even say he robbed a bank down there that doesn't even show that he had anything to do with, but it shows in them files.
Wow.
There's actually a New York Times article that was in the FBI files that said that there was officials in Tucson believe that there was loot buried out there. And to me, you know, it may sound silly, but it's actually possible because the gang was in Tucson for about 3 or 4 days before they were arrested.
Yes.
So, you know, it's like, hey, this is a great vacation spot.
They stayed at the Congress and John had a house.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
anyway, yes, the answer is a lot of wind went out of our sails at that point because it's like I couldn't believe that the level of excitement that we had about this map would not have been
exciting.
And
they're questioning it.
Yeah, and then they just questioned us and just blew it off as, oh, well, that's fake. Well, it wasn't fake. And it's actually a very valid investigative thing to do on a historical figure.
On the family side, you do not want to exhume a family member.
Well, yeah.
That's not something
you don't do.
That was kind of hard to take. I pretty much said, man, that ain't happening.
I mean, I remember that. You kind of got a little emotional when your dad was here because we're thinking, you know, about grandma.
She would never wanted that to happen.
Right. And I remember that because, at this point, I'd become really good friends with Mike and Travis. And so, I'm just looking at it strictly historically this is an investigation, and this is the logical step. If this imposter theory is out there, and we all know that it's been out there for years, so why not? Let's just solve this once and for all. It's just a matter of digging the body up and testing, and we'll have it done. And then we'll move on. That was really my thought. But I understood that the emotional problem that you guys had.
At that time,
with it.
My mom had only been gone 4 years, not even quite 4 years.
But nonetheless, I continued. So I start looking into this. I'm like, okay, what's the background? What's the basis of this imposter theory? Where does it come from? And again, because I had known about the Dillinger case since I was a little boy, I read the J. Robert Nash book when I was a kid about it was called Dillinger Dead or Alive. And Nash was the first author to point out all these discrepancies that were between the known physical characteristics of Dillinger and the body that an autopsy was done on. And there were a lot of discrepancies: the eye color, the size of the body. There were scars. There were known scars that were there.
Think
he had a heart. The body that was dead had a heart condition that would not have been consistent with the athletic ability of Dillinger. So really, frankly, those discrepancies had never really been fully addressed. I know that
they'd never been compiled before. I think Nash was the first one to compile them, but they were well in newspaper reports dating back into the 30s and 40s. I mean, almost as soon as the body wasn't even cold yet, and there was rumors that it was not him.
This doesn't look like him. It doesn't
exactly
look like him. So, and that's one of the things is certainly nobody that's dead, that's not their best day. So you don't look your best. So, you know, that could account for why so many people said that doesn't look like him and so forth. So as I really started looking into this, I looked at what Nash had found, and really what I guess intrigued me about it was in the FBI file, there were numerous people that wrote the FBI that said, hey, is this true? And the official answer was no, he was killed. The fingerprints matched, and end of story. But they never truly addressed what Nash had found, these discrepancies.
Well, he was misidentified the whole time, even when he was alive. You know, he's sitting at the farm, and it's like, oh, Dillinger was just spotted here. And there were so many guys. There was one guy, I think, was arrested 5 or 6 times for being John Dillinger because he looked like him, and it wasn't him.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out, okay, how do we go with this? How do we make this an investigation? And so I actually started looking at pictures of Dillinger that were taken in the morgue, you know, various angles of his face and of his head. And something I started noticing, something looks, obviously, again, no one looks good when they're dead, but something looked off. And I know that he had plastic surgery. So the cleft in his chin was gone. There was a mole that had been removed between the eyebrows. There was, I think, a mole that was on the nose that had been removed. And so he had had a facelift. All this was known. But still, something's not right. And so what I looked at was, it eventually hit me, these ears are different. And I knew from looking at the file, the statement of the plastic surgeons that actually did the work, because the FBI interviewed them at length, there was no work done on the ears. And the ears, if you look at the corpse straight on, the ears are very close to the head, whereas if you look at a mugshot of Dillinger face on, the ears protrude pretty prominently.
Yeah.
And if you look at it from the side, the ears, to the angle that they're on the head, they tilt a different direction. The inner parts of the ear are different, and it's pretty hard to reconcile that. When I actually started looking at it close, and I looked at it, side to side, as close as I could get with it, that's when I said, you know, just like the treasure hunt idea, there's something valid here to look at. Okay. My feeling is it probably was Dillinger that was killed, but this is a valid question to ask.
What you put together definitely made me have more doubt.
And just for clarification purposes, Stuart, what we're talking about is Stuart went in all in using his training to put a report together on the arguments on why it's not Dillinger in the grave, using forensics, fingerprints, the ear differences.
Yes.
The scar was a big one. His tooth was another one.
Yes.
So you went crazy, quote unquote, and went hard to try to put this together so that you guys can make an argument in court.
I did. And again, like I would have done as an FBI investigator, with my own cases, I try to look at, okay, if I'm going to actually present a case that's going to ultimately result in someone possibly going to jail, I want to be as sure as possible that I'm right about it, right? So I actually look at my own case and try to attack it and see, okay, where am I wrong? What are the weaknesses of it? And I try to war game it like that so that what I'm seeing is that this is the truth. This is what it is. And so I went at it exactly like that. How can I explain the differences in the eye color? How can I explain the differences in these ears? And for me, one of the big things beyond the ears, because the ears I have no explanation for. They are drastically different. The other thing that I wanted to really key in on was the fingerprints, because that's what the FBI, that's been their argument for all these years, is that, yeah, we got Dillinger because the fingerprints match. And at the time in 1934, fingerprints would have been the top thing for identification. That was in science, that was the high point, because there was no DNA. And the FBI prided itself on being a fingerprint repository, and they had the experts that were, you know, in analyzing fingerprints and making these identifications. And so when I started looking at the known fingerprints of Dillinger versus the fingerprints taken of the man in the morgue, one of the other things, I'll backtrack just a quick second, is when Dillinger had the plastic surgery to change his face, he also had the cores of his fingertips mutilated, which would not make fingerprint identification impossible. It just makes it difficult to begin Don't know how interested your listeners would be in the ins and outs of fingerprint analysis, because it can get very technical. But nonetheless, Dillinger had the cores of his fingers mutilated to really complicate fingerprint identification. But again, an identification can be made even with that mutilation on there. So that's, to me, that was not any real obstacle that couldn't have been overcome. So I actually started looking at the fingerprints myself, and I, you know, beyond just the basic training in fingerprints, that's all I've got. I'm not, I don't hold myself out to be an investigator, but I know the process and how it works. And so what jumped out at me was, I found, let's just say, for instance, on the left index finger, I found matching points of identification between Dillinger's known fingerprints and the dead guy's fingerprints. And you see this formation on the fingers, and it's like, wow, okay, that's so unique. This has to match. That's him. That's okay. So for me, I'm like, okay, boy, it's hard to get past that. Even with the ears and the eye color discrepancy, it's hard to get past that this little fleck of a fingerprint thing matches. Okay, what are the odds of that? So the way it's done is you find a matching point like that, and then you count ridges over, and you find maybe another unique pattern, okay? And what jumped out at me was, on certain fingers, I could count ridges over and find a matching unique pattern. On other fingers, I couldn't. So I might find a pattern that matched, okay? But then when I started counting over two or three ridges over, I'd find a wholly different formation, okay, that didn't match at all. And on some fingers, I couldn't even find a matching formation to begin with to even start. So
wow.
That's what I'm saying. I don't understand how to reconcile that. To me, that is a real question. So one of the things that I found and that to me
that's
stuck out in the FBI files was, it's mentioned repeatedly that an analysis was done and that over 300 points of identification were found, and that it just meant beyond a shadow of a doubt that this is Dillinger. Well, however, that report and whatever the name of that fingerprint examiner was that found those 300 points is not in that file. I cannot find it anywhere. Now, and one of the things that the FBI has always prided itself on is the thoroughness and the detail of the investigation and of the reports. And I it's just not there. The detail where these matching points were, it is not in that file. So the only thing that I found that is potentially might explain what I'm seeing, and that is some fingers match and others absolutely do not match, is that when the fingers were mutilated, there was a potential, what the examiner who wrote this report that I'm referring to, what he mentioned was what he called a puckering, that maybe that this, and Dillinger had actually used acid on his fingertips to cause this mutilation, and that this acid might have somehow caused these fingerprint ridges to pucker, and which deform them obviously and cause this unique situation that I think he was saying the same thing I'm saying. He didn't understand why some things match and some things didn't match. But he didn't go as far to say, well, it's not Dillinger, it still matches. But he was just trying to explain there's an anomaly in here that we don't get. So for purposes of, if I'm looking at this as a maybe a defense attorney rather than an FBI agent, I'm thinking, you know, we have to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, there's a little bit of doubt here because okay, it may be attributed to puckering when Dillinger had the fingerprints mutilated, but nonetheless, there's still some doubt because puckering or not, whatever, they don't match. There's parts of those fingerprints that do not match. So for me, that's when I concluded that this is valid. This is something that really is a historically important mystery here that deserves to be investigated.
I don't find the fingerprint evidence as compelling as Stewart does, because again, if the theory that a lot of people have about him getting away, and again, we know he liked to call and taunt to the police, so if they had shot the wrong guy again in Chicago, I'm pretty sure he would have called the FBI and said, hey, I'm still alive, you miss me. So if he wanted to get out of the life of crime go straight, which, again, that's part of the theory. He could have surrendered himself and, you know, to go ahead and get his fingerprints taken. There was some discrepancies. For one thing, the autopsy report from Chicago, from the Cook County, County Coroner's Office, it disappeared for like 50 years. Showed up again like 1974 in a paper bag behind a filing cabinet. And I'm not sure, because I was able to track that down in my research, and I'm not sure that that's accurate. Again, there was some discrepancies as far as the FBI taking his fingerprints and the Chicago PD taking his fingerprints. Supposedly those two fingerprints didn't match. As when the FBI came back and retook the fingerprints when he was in the morgue, that the fingerprints matched. So, again, the fingerprints that we have of the corpse and the fingerprints that we have that we know were John's, they could very well match, but still doesn't mean he didn't get away and didn't surrender and give his fingerprints so that it would match.
Wow. Wow. You guys are going crazy right now. So
the one reason the family always said was because it was so hot, the body laid for some time, mm-hmm. that it distorted the features and stuff. That's one reason. That's what a lot of my mother
and
would say.
I thought the same thing. So I'd heard those same arguments myself. So I looked into that, and there actually, believe it or not, is research on what happens to the color of an eye, the iris, after death. And the study that I read, there are actually a handful of studies about it, but the one that I read said that it had been studied in various temperatures and various conditions, and that essentially the color of the iris does not change in the most extreme cases.
And I've seen the research that you've done, and you can see in the pictures, 27 hours after postmortem, what a blue eye looks like, and it ain't brown.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't change that drastic.
Right. No.
But that's what the family always said.
Exactly. So what occurs is what's called corneal clouding, and then the cornea of the eye is this clear membrane or substance that sits over the iris that after death will actually start turning opaque. Start clouding
it up.
And so what happens is depending on the amount of clouding, it just makes it difficult to see the specific color.
Gotcha.
Okay? So that's what it is. But the actual color of the eye does not change.
Well, didn't you, your research, didn't the, I mean, the autopsy was performed less than 12 hours after death, wasn't it?
I don't know the specific time from time of death until the autopsy was done, but it was done within 12 hours. I do know that. Yes, but I don't know. I don't know if it was 3 hours.
Because it was done the following morning, I think, because he was shot, 10:35? What time of death was like 10:35, 10:40?
10:40 p.m.
Yeah, and it was the next morning, I believe, that they performed
that
autopsy.
That's all the file says is the morning. But that could be 3 o'clock in the morning. It could be 8 o'clock the next morning.
Still within 12 hours, though.
Within 12 hours, yes.
Within 12 hours, yes. Understood. So those are some of the main arguments. Are there any other arguments that you put in that document to bring to court for the exhumation?
So there were some known scars that Dillinger had. In fact, the FBI, what's called an identification order, which is that's just what the Bureau calls it, it basically would be a wanted poster. You know, a wanted poster has a detailed description of the wanted person. And in that, the FBI listed a scar on the upper lip and a half-inch scar on one of his hands. I'm forgetting.
But that was it. So just those
that's
two.
That's what they said. But neither of those scars were described in the autopsy. Another discrepancy about scars is on March 13th, 1934, Dillinger was wounded in a bank robbery in Mason City, Iowa, and he was shot in the right shoulder. Okay, that scar. There's no scar mentioned
in the autopsy
that would be in the right shoulder area. The only thing that is described in the autopsy is a scar that was on the left side of the neck, that and and I, in my research, I know of no injury that Dillinger had to the left side of the neck.
And there should have been one on the upper thigh on one leg.
That actually was there. Okay, so so again, it's one of these weird things where something matches, but then another thing completely does not match.
But the one thing that you think is the ears. The ears are just completely...
So the way I war game the ears was, okay, so what would the explanation for this be? Well, one of the things we know is that Dillinger, there were 3 to 4 death masks made of Dillinger while he was in the morgue, and this process of putting, I don't know, plaster of Paris or whatever the material was over the face to make a mold so that you can make a mask of it. So in the process of putting this death mask on him, that would have pinched the ears down, and maybe that's why they would be so looking so close to the head,
sure,
versus protruding. But how would that affect the ears that when they don't match when you look at it from the side? Because I'm telling you, the inner structure of the ear is different,
yeah,
and the angle of the ear to the head is different. The Dillinger's ears, it's hard to describe here on radio, but if you put a line straight through Dillinger's ear,
sure,
up and down, his ear would tilt more forward.
Sure.
Okay. The body that's in the morgue, the ear tilts more to the rear. Okay. That would not change by that. Death would not cause that. A death mask on, a facelift, none of that would cause this drastic of a change to the ear.
It just leaves more questions.
It does.
Right. Well, that was the thing when I read his report, I was very excited about, because again, the thing with the ears, even if it was not mentioned, during the plastic surgeon's deposition that they had worked on the ears, pulling back the ears, making them flatter against the skull is not going to change the inner cartilage. I mean, it's the inner cartilage. When you compare those two pictures,
it's like a fingerprint.
Right. And again, these two bozos that were the plastic surgeons, I think technically were doctors for the day,
yeah,
but they were both alcoholics, but they were both criminals.
Yeah.
And so I don't think they were sophisticated enough to change the inner structure of an ear.
Yeah.
Got it. Can't change the inner structure of an ear. Got it. 1934. Understood.
Right. And my mother said it didn't really change his appearance that much.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes.
She saw him after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
for that time, they wasn't as good as they are now. But she said, you know, it didn't, for what he went through or whatever, it didn't really change his appearance.
And the FBI file kind of corroborates that, but one of Dillinger's associates was Homer Van Meter. Van Meter also had plastic surgery done at the same time. And the doctors were a little bit nervous because neither Dillinger nor Van Meter were happy with the results. And so I think the doctor was a little bit worried that he might be in trouble.
Repercussions.
But it is reported that it didn't change the appearance very much.
Didn't do that much.
You put all this effort in, and I'm bringing this back now. Unless there's something else that you missed that in that the report that you think the listeners need to hear.
Well, there is one other interesting thing, and that,
please,
that if your listeners in the Indy area may be familiar with this part of the story as well. And this was something that was documented in Mr. Nash's book, Dillinger Dead or Alive, was in 1959, an individual sent a letter to the Indianapolis Star, or the Indy Star, that included a picture and claimed that he was Dillinger. It was maybe a 3-paragraph letter about what happened, that he pointed out that I think the eye color didn't match, you know, and as Scott mentioned, you know, the autopsy was not public all these years, and certainly in 1959 it wouldn't have been public information. So this discrepancy about the eye color would not have really been public information. And so this letter pointed that out, and pointed out a couple of other things that, seemed to hint that maybe only Dillinger would have known, or certainly would have been information that was probably not known to the general public. But anyway, he included a picture of it with himself. And if you look at it, it's an older guy. You can tell it's a few years later. I think Dillinger would have been in maybe his mid to late 50s or so. And you look at it and you think, maybe not. So again, just like with the fingerprints, I took the picture of the known Dillinger, and I took a picture of the old man, and I put them side by side, and I
quadded them. You halved them
exactly.
You split them up so that you saw the exactly. eyes only.
I
with
basically
the,
did a ballistics test.
It was good.
The way
it
a ballistics good. Test Amazing. Is done. Yeah. And I could not
believe
it. And
we have approval from the family. Yes,
I could not believe it when I would match these halves of pictures up together, known Dillinger and the old man, that the shape of the eye matched, the distance between the eye and the mouth matched, the nose, all of it just matched perfectly.
And isn't this? And the ears matched.
And the ears matched. They
it blew me. I mean, it blew me away when I first seen it.
Yes,
I think I have that letter in picture because he wrote "Mom," and I have it.
That's actually news to me.
I do have. I
Joe,
have,
your listeners
I have
are hearing
to,
up.
I have to
I hope
dig
hearing
through
the shock in my voice.
some stuff, but I believe I have that.
Okay, because he also the same person. In 1963, wrote a letter to the owner of the Little Bohemia Lodge where the famous Dillinger shootout had happened, and essentially said the same thing. That and I think he added that now he had lived in California all these years, and the return or it said it was from Hollywood, California, where he
there was
mention of California mm-hmm. is a big deal.
Yeah, there was yes. One letter to Mom. From to individual
to your mom
to my mother,
not from not
Francis.
To his mom, yep. Yeah,
and which would have been I was 15 or 16, so we're talking 69, 70, and stating to my mother he was John, mm-hmm. and they could go on Johnny Carson. and I believe I have that letter still, and but I told my mother, I said, Johnny Carson. I said, well, you gotta go.
But you know, again, so anyway, so he wrote again to the owner of the Little Bohemia, similar letter to the 1959 letter to the Indy Star. The picture he included in 63, you know, same guy, just a little bit older. I put that picture through the same analysis I did with the other. Again, eyes,
wow.
lips, ears, it all matches. Structure of the face, it all matches. So it's one of those things that, again, it's so compelling. But then you look at the handwriting that's on the letter. Okay, so I thought, okay, is this Dillinger's handwriting?
Sure.
And I've looked at enough of Dillinger's known writing that I kind of know what it looks like. And if you look at the writing in the 59 and the 63 letters, it doesn't look the same. Okay,
wow.
But here's another anomaly that jumped out at me is, it's much better writing in the later letters, right? So you think that someone's handwriting can change, but it generally gets worse as you get older. The handwriting was much better than Dillinger's, but then when I actually started looking at some individual characters in the handwriting, lo and behold, guess what? There's things that just match dead on. So I
yeah. it is. It's just this left and right battle.
Yes. It is.
When he wrote home,
it's
he always
like we're talking
signed
about two different people.
Johnny.
Wow.
You know, mm-hmm. when he wrote his dad, he wrote his sisters, it was always signed Johnny. So when he wrote someone else, it wasn't signed that way.
Yes.
Wow.
And I believe the letter was Johnny, yeah. signed Johnny.
Right. Yeah.
So that is super compelling on a lot of different fronts. I mean, right now, I mean, if I was listening to this and I was listening to my own podcast, I would completely think that's not John Dillinger. That was not John Dillinger who's killed
right.
at the Biograph.
Right.
But the anomalies also make me think, huh, maybe it was.
Yeah.
Maybe the fingerprints, yeah. all of that. So I appreciate right. the incredible amount of work that you did.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure that this research was done, and
I'll go on record here and say that I don't think it's him.
Yeah, we know, Scott.
Something doesn't feel right.
The thing that for me is, I agree that the evidence is compelling and it certainly justifies asking the question. There's no doubt about it.
And isn't that the point here? Look, we're not trying to prove yes or no through evidence, which is why you guys wanted. once you had this, to go to court to make it known, to make it a real deal.
Yes.
So once the History Channel, we're going back, once I'm keeping us on track, the History Channel said, no, no more money. We want to go after the mystery of who he is, whether or not he's in the grave, right?
Well, while getting the permits to exhume through the health department, going to Crown Hill, which Crown Hill was all on board when we first approached them about exhuming the body.
I was there. Me and the producer, Paul, went to Crown Hill for a meeting. They didn't know what the meeting was about until we got there.
But they knew you. They knew you from years, right? Didn't they know you before that? No, they didn't know
Did not know me at all. No.
Okay.
So when I show up with Paul and we walk in and kind of the mood, they're welcoming. They're nice, polite, but concerned because they didn't know what this was about. They had to sign a non-disclosure.
Can I interrupt just real quick?
Sure,
so
please.
So that the listeners might understand what we're talking about. So at this point, you know, we found really some compelling evidence. Mike and Travis were reluctant at first that, you know, hey, but when they actually saw that there might be some substance to this.
Enough.
This is something
really
to look
changed
into,
our mind.
Then we really started looking whole, you know, completely as to, okay, so, yeah, so the way to solve this is an exhumation. So how do we do that? What's the process? And so in my own research, it's actually not that difficult, but it's basically the requirements in Indiana are family consent, next of kin consent, cemetery consent, and a permit from the Department of Health.
Department.
That's the basic thing. There might be a few other
easy peasy lemon squeezy.
There are a few other administrative requirements, but that's the basic process. So
and
that's
you found
why,
the statute in Indiana state statutes that says that if for identification purposes, if a family wants to exhume a body for identification purposes, that they are completely allowed to do that.
Yes.
Okay. I just want to put that on record.
Well,
because it's in the state.
Not so much that for identification purposes, but to exhume the body for whatever purpose. It may be to move the body.
Sure, sure.
I mean, there are a number of reasons for an exhumation.
Sure.
Okay.
But one of them is identifications.
Possibly. Okay. But at this point, we're not. That's an exception to the statute. The basic statute is next of kin consent, cemetery consent, and a Department of Health permit. Okay, that's the basic. So that's where we started. And so
we had all that when we went to Crown Hill.
Correct. So I'll back off.
And Paul and Travis went.
We went and had a meeting
to get Crown Hill's consent.
Yeah, with the Crown Hill president and two other individuals inside the organization of Crown Hill. Okay.
And they had assigned a non-disclosure.
Yeah, they had assigned a non-disclosure. They had no idea what this is about John at all. So we go in there, and we presented them with evidence that Stuart had put together for just this meeting. We're talking to him. We dropped the bombshell that, you know, hey, we're the family, and we don't really believe it's him by the evidence. At first, you know, they were on board with it.
Wow.
In the meeting, they were like, this is going to be.
And you showed them the cop.
I showed them a picture of the deed, which they had no copy of.
I have the original
deed.
They don't even have a copy
of it.
Family plot.
The president, you know, he was like, this is huge news. They're worried about, like, oh, my God, all these people are going to be coming here. You know, it's going to disrupt all this stuff. But they were on board with it because of the evidence that we presented them, and it was a family of wishes. So we had the meeting. Everything was good. We left after that,
and you
periodically
stayed in contact with them.
I would stay in contact. I would stop in, talk to them. I'd mention that once the news broke to everyone that we were trying to do, people started coming up and vandalizing not just John's headstone, but also my great-grandfather's.
They probably didn't know the difference, those dumb.
No, they don't pay attention to the dates.
They were chipping away at both of them.
So I would, you know, I'd stop in and be like, hey, I'm noticing more damage. What can we do about this? And they would go out there, take photographs, and, you know, they would invite me in. I could, you know, get me a drink. Everything was good. Everything was great until one Monday afternoon when
after it leaked.
after it leaked.
That's the key. I was waiting for someone to say it.
Yeah.
After it leaked.
After it leaked out.
Because the reason it leaked
was the health department tipped a news reporter.
Gosh, those news reporters.
I know how they are.
They're so sneaky.
They tipped the. That's a good lead for that news reporter. I don't know who it was. It wasn't me. I tell you that. I wasn't in news when it was happening.
Another network.
Yeah, it was another network. It's okay. I don't hold grudges. Good reporting skills. So that health reporter, health department tipped the reporter. The reporter's like,
and it broke. Yeah, they showed up my driveway at 8:05 on a Monday morning,
and you were like. Holy.
Well, I recognized who it was, even though they didn't have a vehicle saying the station's name on it. But I recognized him. My wife was getting ready to go out the door with two grandsons, and she wasn't too pleased. So I brought him over to my building to talk to him so she could take the grandkids out. And
I wasn't too pleased, Diesler, because they didn't tell me.
We're being contacted from everywhere.
So
once it broke, Australia, Russia, England,
Smithsonian Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
It was Rolling Stones.
It was unbelievable. Do you remember? Always wanted to be on the cover.
What
time
was, or what date was that? Do you guys remember when it broke? We can look it up. It's okay. Yeah, point being is it went everywhere.
But after it broke, we were excited. I mean, we were excited, not excited. But that's when the investigation went off the rails. I mean, it turned to a huge train wreck.
Allegedly, a government official went to Crown Hill.
And asked for copies of all the Dillinger files they had on the grave.
And you know this, why?
Someone inside of Crown Hill that worked there.
That you was in contact
leaked that
with.
Information. But not only did I hear it from someone inside Crown Hill.
The news.
Some news from another state contacted me. Like, what do you know about the FBI showing up?
Allegedly FBI. Somebody.
And that's what I heard from them. The media was like, okay, supposedly the FBI showed up. And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. You know, we're learning this literally when the news broke. We're
when
learning
the news,
news
is
stuff.
Telling us.
Yeah, the news is telling us stuff. And it pretty much started falling apart after that. Because
like 24 hours after it broke, or
pretty quick.
Pretty quick. Yeah. Supposedly the day that this government agency showed up and asked
probably
for the copy
within
of the files,
24 hours.
That was the same day they stopped working with us.
Then we find out that, and they definitely stated, I'm not saying this because I don't know for a fact, but somebody at the health department told my lawyer that the FBI come to them and didn't want them to give me another permit to exhume the body.
Wow.
And during this time, the FBI is also tweeting, which is, you could probably ask Stuart.
Well, yeah, we have
not
a
common for the FBI to talk about what, much of anything.
Generally, what they tweet about today is just if they had a success in a particular case, if they won in a court case or they made a significant arrest, not really to comment on an ongoing civil matter that really they have no jurisdiction over.
So you were surprised by their reaction?
I was really surprised about it. I really was. And I mean, I understand it because so much of the reputation of the FBI was based on the fact that they got Dillinger, you know, back then. And for those out there that are listening that don't really know it, Dillinger was a big deal at the time. And so it was huge that they did that.
It kind of helped form the FBI.
It really did. It was really a little known agency at the time. And so really the reputation of the Bureau was made beginning with Dillinger. So, it is unusual that they would comment on it like they did, but maybe in some way I can kind of see it. But again, it's one other thing that there's an explanation for it, but it is unusual.
The FBI went back to the fingerprints in the tweet. They said this is how they identified the body. And then we had reporters.
The one reporter contacted the Chicago office and then
DC
office
and Indianapolis
and
office.
One of them made the comment, we cannot talk about an ongoing case. What ongoing case?
Yeah, what ongoing case?
Supposedly you closed this.
Yeah. Well, and it just brought something to mind in those files. that in those files, in the FBI files that we were talking about earlier, they were still looking for John in 1962 in them files.
Unbelievable. So so it is maybe ongoing.
So I don't know.
Mr. Scott.
What's kind of crazy about Crown Hill pulling out like that too and saying, well, they don't want to do this exhumation. I was there in court with them. I hadn't actually got brought on board with this yet. Just kind of peripherally giving support. But Crown Hill was so adamant and very hostile. I mean, very hostile towards allowing this exhumation to go. And it's part of, a 2007 law that went into effect. But they were the first time in Indiana history since this law has been in effect that a cemetery has not granted permission for a family to exhume a relative. And what I find so fascinating or so mysterious about that is that Crown Hill has given permission to the Dillinger family to exhume that body once before, back in 1934. They gave it to John W. Dillinger after he was buried, after John H., right, the bank robber, was buried. His dad got permission to exhume that body to put allegedly the concrete and the scrap metal on top. So Crown Hill's already given permission once before. Why are they taking it back now? Why are they not cooperating now?
Question.
The judge, while we was there, they had three lawyers, Crown Hill. The gal was the one that got up and talked. But pretty much the judge goes, so you can just say no, no reason. So it can be a cloudy day, no exhumations. He said, and so basically that's what it was. They didn't have to have a reason, just no. And he goes, and another thing he brought up, he says, if this wasn't John Dillinger, we wouldn't be here. She didn't know what to say.
So
give many permissions to exhume, but not this one.
Stuart, what did the judge say about Crown Hill? Well, I can't.
Well, essentially, he asked for their reasoning as to why they're not giving consent.
And they had none.
And he acknowledged, the judge acknowledged that they don't have to actually have a reason, but just really, I just want to know why is your reason. And I believe it was they were worried about a cave-in.
Crown Hill.
Crown Hill.
Crown Hill was concerned about a cave-in, maybe, a
disruption.
Disruption, yeah. And so forth. And the judge just kind of just said, I don't believe you. I really don't. I don't buy what you're saying here.
But
I can't do anything because the statute says that you cannot, and it has to be your consent, but there's no stipulation as to...
Well, didn't the judge say that Crown Hill was being cruel or...
He did. Yeah,
he did.
Yeah.
But cruel, what do you mean by that?
By cruel, by denying the family.
Oh.
The way my lawyer had filed it was under one paragraph. There's like five paragraphs, right. And she only filed it under this one. If she had filed it under maybe that one and a couple others, it could have got done.
Well, and so this is what I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, go ahead.
So the basic requirements of a exhumation in Indiana: cemetery consent, next of kin consent, and Department of Health. So, but within that, there are a couple of exceptions to that. One is that if the family wants to move the body to another cemetery, in other words, Uncle Billy is buried in one cemetery and Aunt Sue is in another one.
Want to put them together.
And if the family wants to move Aunt Sue and put them together, that they don't need cemetery. The family wouldn't need cemetery consent to do that. That's not really applicable here because no one in the family really wants to move the body. If it's him, he is where he needs to be. The other exception is for an autopsy. And that is, we all think that the purpose of an autopsy is to determine the cause of death, but there are actually several other reasons for an autopsy, and one being identification of the body. And so if you request an exhumation under the autopsy exception to the statute, then you do not need cemetery consent, okay?
Again, we do want to do an autopsy, I think, because, again, to determine cause of death, with the autopsy report disappearing for such a length of time, We don't know how accurate that thing is. So, again, if the FBI or whoever was in charge up there in Chicago were possibly made a mistake, there's reasons that some of those reports might not be accurate. I mean, it's only going to bolster, again, if it is him, it's only going to bolster the FBI's claim and the Cook County coroner's claim. So I would argue that, yeah, autopsy is exactly what we want to do, not just for by identification, but to determine cause of death.
Well, okay, but the other thing is, I believe we have very valid reasons to request an autopsy, that because the identification in my mind is not certain. It really is in doubt. It's greatly in doubt.
And I would have always said in years past, you know, the family's always said, but with all the stuff we found in the files and what you put together, definitely give us enough doubt that I want to know.
But right. But something happened because you have all this and you're making the argument. The judge sounded like he was on your side.
He definitely was on our side.
But what happened?
He couldn't. His hands were tied under what my lawyer filed.
Under that hearing, the judge had to rule in favor of the cemetery.
He asked my lawyer, do you have something else? If she would have filed under
requesting
one of those
an
other
autopsy.
One. Yeah.
So if she had requested an autopsy as opposed to filing
she filed
just for
an exhumation.
A general exhumation. Exactly.
So if she had filed, because he goes, do you have something else? My hands are kind of tied on what
he was giving
filed,
it to you.
But
he was giving it to her.
Oh, he was. All she had to do is if she would have filed another in those, I think there was five paragraphs she could have filed under.
Was your evidence, Stuart, in the court filings?
Where, no.
Did, okay,
no.
Great. That's
not
good.
Then.
Because, under the general statute, there's really, I suppose maybe the judge could have asked for an evidentiary hearing to say, why are the family doing this? But and the judge's point was, as long as the cemetery is not consenting, there's no point in doing an evidentiary here because it doesn't matter why the family wants to do this, because if the cemetery says no, there's nothing that can be done
except
under
for
this part
exactly.
of the
and
statute.
The judge had the three lawyers for Crown him and him in chambers
before
for a good half hour, maybe longer,
with your lawyer
before they walked into the courtroom.
Yes.
And he wasn't happy with them. And then you could tell he wasn't happy with them when it started. But the way my lawyer filed, there was nothing he could do.
Yeah. But something happened before we got the court, though, that we probably should talk about, was History Channel backing out of the project prior to court.
Oh, yeah, right.
That's true.
That's right. Yeah. Right before we
And we
went
didn't
to
know
court.
About it. A reporter here in Indianapolis contacted me that early morning and was like, did you guys know that History wasn't working with you anymore? I'm like, no, what are you talking about?
No, neither did the production company.
She said that she received an email from History Channel that they were no longer working with on the Dillinger project. And I started firing texts off to Dad, Stuart, trying to see what they had heard. They didn't hear nothing about it. I started, sharing links to the news report. Then I started sharing links to
which
the
was
production
fairly early in the production companies in LA, so they're 3 hours behind.
They
us.
Didn't even know about it,
right?
And how I understood it, History sent out just a blanket email to all the media that they were no longer working on the project.
That must have been disheartening.
It really was
before going to court.
It was kind of a shock.
Yes, because we had actually been told that hey, History's behind this project. We've had a hiccup here with Crown Hill withdrawing their consent, but if we go forward and there's litigation, they're going to support us. And then it turned out that they didn't. And in fact, they didn't even bother to tell us first that they were going to pull out.
And pretty much a week away from what we were told as starting to film,
we really never got a straight answer.
No.
To why. They backed out
because you would have started filming which mystery, the money or the.
Well, we would have. They were all ready to go on the exhumation,
right?
If the courtroom had went, we would have started immediately. They were ready to roll.
But they backed out before we could even get to court.
Yep. So they backed out before we sat down in the courtroom. Yeah.
And I am in suspense for almost 2 years waiting for this thing to be shown on TV. And again, they pulled the plug. I'm like, oh, man.
Yeah, because how I understood, we were going to be filming, you know, showing the public
the court,
our investigation of the going, you know, to court, going through everything to get to the examination.
Because they had cameras waiting as soon as we walked down the camera room or the courtroom, and they were all waiting. So, I mean, it was all, and then we was going to go on to the examination.
And really, why we're here and why I want you guys to tell your story in the way that you're telling it is because a lot of that news that made it across the world, then all of a sudden you had a microphone shoved in your face out of court.
Go everywhere.
and you couldn't, and you weren't getting your full story out, that people were misconstruing why you guys wanted to go to court. They hear History Channel, they hear Mystery of Money, and they hear exhumation.
Exactly.
And all you can think of, they're doing it for money.
Yep. Right.
That's exactly all they
thought.
And as, I mean, to the listeners, the production company backed out. History Channel backed out. We've been continuing this investigation just with the four of us.
So
Travis, why don't you tell us how much they've paid us so far?
Zero.
A big zero.
This is not about the money.
Yeah, we've been spending
you guys lost money.
Everyone here is in the hole.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when they pulled out, and that was, I think, September, right, of 20... When was that?
It was maybe in October or so. And
probably
then we went to court in December.
October.
Yeah. We went. I know the hearing was
towards the end of October.
And this is 2019.
Correct.
2019. Yeah.
Right. So that was kind of like.
So we actually went. Did we go to court?
December of 2019, I think.
Yeah.
December of 2019. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you did, because I remember the day.
But pretty much since that day, we've been kind of working. And we got off our non-disclosure in March.
Well, so it continued a little bit after the hearing, and what really happened, I think, is the production company just, you know, the folks that write the checks for them just decided that, you know, hey, guys, we've been pursuing this.
Yeah.
We're not seeing a lot of, you know, we see a lot of headaches going forward, and I think they just made the decision from a financial standpoint that this is just not... it's a cost-benefit thing, and, you know, we spent a lot of cost here, and we're not getting any benefit.
We're not getting any farther,
So they backed out, and to a certain extent, I understand that. And so, you know, at that point, Travis and I kind of just said, you know what, TV or not.
Yeah, we got this far.
These questions are valid. I want to keep going forward, and I'm willing to come out of my own pocket here to just try to solve it. I really honestly don't care if, you know, if there's ever a TV deal, if anybody ever finds out about it. But to me, this is a legitimate historical mystery that at least deserves a final answer. And so that's why we have proceeded and gone forth on our own.
Yeah. And we have no ill will towards anyone. FBI, Crown Hill.
The truth
needs to come out,
exactly.
Regardless
that's
of what
it,
if it rewrites history, it rewrites history. But it will be right, and the truth will be out there.
Exactly.
That's all we care about.
On the other side of that equation, if it is him, then, you know, it justifies the work that those young FBI agents did in those days. And, you know, three FBI agents were killed in the hunt for the Dillinger gang. So, you know, it would be a tribute to those guys if it is him, and that we can finally say this is him.
And the other law enforcement officers that were killed.
It wasn't just FBI. There were others
as well. The sheriffs.
But, you know, it doesn't matter which way it goes. The map is still a mystery that we can still try to solve.
Is still,
it's huge.
Yes,
that's a huge mystery.
And we are currently.
The address book.
Yes.
I mean, all that, whether he's in the ground.
Right.
Was that maybe a route that he was going to take or something later? Or if it's not him, did he go somewhere on that map and pick up money and
get away?
That map means something.
Get away. Exactly.
Because there is dates that go past
when
the supposed death date.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
in the FBI files.
No, on the map.
The
map goes past
dates
the
on
date.
The map go past July 22nd, 1934.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's still, even if we put away the mystery, who's in the ground, him or not, then the mystery is, what did this mean? Who's these people in that address?
We are currently close to...
Very close.
To potentially saying that this map is Dillinger's through DNA testing.
Whoa. You're telling me you guys are working on something bigger than what we're talking about?
Well...
No, it's big.
Yeah.
It's big, yes.
It would be big to be able to definitively say that that map is John Dillinger's and we can prove it definitively with the most definitive science we have.
I love
DNA
it.
DNA testing.
Yes. I love it. That's so exciting. It gets my heart racing.
It is really cool.
Scott, you wanted to...
Well, I was just going to add to everything, too. Like Stuart said, I mean, getting verification of the body would vindicate, you know, if it is him and it's positive, would, you know, be a tribute to law enforcement who actually did to get him. But again, the mystery of the map and the mystery, if it's not him, then you've got a whole nother mystery to solve. Where did he go? How did he live his life? Now, we know Walter Dietrich, who was one of the guys that escaped from Michigan City with Dillinger's help. He ended up turned himself in. He did his prison time. I think he got out in like 54. And he lived a quiet life in St. Louis as a union pipe fitter and died in 1979. So it's not impossible for someone who's a criminal to go straight.
He was one of the architects of the bank robbery. With the driver.
With Baron Lamb. Yeah. Walter Dietrich was one of the guys that learned from the Baron Lamb, who was a World War I, for listeners who don't know. He was a World War I vet, is British. He came over here, immigrated, and he actually took bank robbing.
He designed
robbery to a science.
Yeah,
to a higher
he made
level.
It. He designed a way to bank rob.
He was about casing the bank. It was a military precision. And his the one thing he always said too, and then he taught that Walter Dietrich, and then I don't think Pierpont was with him, but I think Pierpont learned from Dietrich and another guy. But was no matter how doesn't matter how much money you get out in a certain amount of time. You're in there 6 minutes or 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever, and you get out. Don't be greedy. Don't, you know, you got to be on the time schedule no matter what. Don't sit there and waste time trying to be greedy and get more. So everything was military precision, and these are the guys that taught Dillinger how to do it.
Yeah, Walter, didn't he teach Dillinger when he was in jail together?
Yeah, when they were at Michigan State together.
He got schooled by the best.
Yeah. Unbelievable. And then he just brought his own flair.
Yep.
So where did he go after... Right.
If
he
got
away
from the biograph, if John Dillinger did get away from the biograph, you know, where did he go? How did he live his life? What did he do for a living? Does Mike and Travis here have any relatives out there?
Right.
No, that'd be quite interesting.
I'd like to know if our family tree
is a little bigger than we think.
Yeah, a little bigger.
So, yeah. I mean, there's a lot to answer.
I mean, John did plan on going straight. I mean, him and Billy.
Yeah, there was one big last robbery plan, which was a train that they.
Yes.
And that was going to be the last deal.
Yes.
You guys, that happened with the court. You guys continue to do your work right now. You guys are working
to
try to
find... That's why Stuart's here today.
Yeah, exactly. That's why he's in Indiana. That's why we get to hang out today.
Exactly, yeah.
I have a small part in this in the sense that I really care about you guys, and I think it's unfair that a minute and a half news story... is portraying what you have to say about your family members and what you want to do about this mystery. So the last 2 hours, because we're at 2 hours.
No kidding.
Wow.
I hope that we were able to kind of clear the air for you.
I hope so. Because I learned one thing dealing with reporters, they may talk to you for 20 minutes. You only see a few seconds of it.
That's right.
And they can make it look any way they want.
That's why you agree to only do podcasts with me.
That's right.
That's right.
And I think both Scott and Stuart's insight has been incredible. I think you guys nailed it, and I hope my listeners got as much as I get out of you both. I think you guys are unbelievable researchers, much better than me.
Huge,
I just like talking.
Huge asset to this team.
Yes, quite. Both of them.
Both of them. Great. Great job.
With Travis, you're okay. You know, you're all right.
I know.
It was your interest that started it all. So you're super interested.
Fired up again. Yes.
Yeah, fired it up. The final thing I kind of want to cover from all of you as we kind of hit the final points here, is where are you going from here? You say you're doing the research. Tell me as much as you can about what you guys are doing specifically to kind of keep the story moving.
Well, what we want to do, again, is this final verification of the map. We actually have DNA on the map. We know that it's male DNA, and we are in the process of testing that against Mike's DNA. We have actually found a lab that will compare Mike with this unknown sample of DNA. We'll come up with we'll be able to tell us if there is a familial link between those two. And what's exciting about it is they also have the potential to tell us the degrees of separation between, if there is a family link, what are the degrees of separation in that family? And because Mike has such a unique connection with Dillinger, he's his nephew, half-nephew, that we will be able to tell, because there's no other person other than Mike has a sister, but there's no other person that has the same relationship that Mike does. So we'll be able to tell if that DNA on that map is Dillinger's. And again, the handwriting already matches. It would just be great if this DNA profile matches Mike's. But again, we have to account for that maybe others could have touched it, that maybe perhaps Dillinger's DNA just for whatever reason didn't get on it. It was in a mason jar for 85 years. There are a lot of factors that could complicate this, but we have our fingers crossed about that. And so that is one of the investigative steps we want to complete. And then we know we're onto something with this map, hey, this was Dillinger's. So that justifies, going forward, trying to find these points on the map that match with the address book and so forth.
So we'll see you around the Midwest, just driving along in your RV.
Exactly.
with the Dillinger gang, a new Dillinger gang.
The Dillinger gang now is right on the trail of the old Dillinger gang. Yes.
Yeah. Again, moving forward with this is really exciting, and it's being able to add to the legend, to verify certain things that we've read about, because again, there is a lot of conflicting information about there. It just makes me very proud that I was able to be allowed to do this with these people. I mean, these are all great people here, and again, to finally solve that mystery, or mysteries, because we have several, but just to be a part of that is just very exciting. And like I said, I hope we can do everybody justice with this.
Mike, I hope. What do you think?
And even if the map doesn't show John, maybe it's Hubert. Maybe Hubert buried a map for John. I don't see Hubert burying a map for him. But, I mean, hopefully it will show if it's Hubert or if it's John. And if we get that solved, and we're working on other things that may be as interesting or more.
I'm just happy that I get to be on this journey with my father.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I've met new friends, and hopefully we can set history straight, good, bad, or indifferent.
Here. The FBI is still chasing Dillinger 86 years from...
yeah, I guess you could say that.
Or still the, on the trail.
The retired FBI is...
maybe just tired. You guys, this is great. Is there anything that we should be looking out for? I mean, are we hearing anything?
You may down the road here maybe get some real big news.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Well,
we'll leave it with that we have some significant investigative activity.
Yes.
I love it. What an FBI freaking answer. You guys have been great. This is an honor for me to know you all, and it one hell of a table here at the Dillinger Den.
It's the hideout.
Hideout. I swear this is the last question because we're running low here. Are you going to go back for the autopsy argument? Can you go back for that?
We can go back for it.
Great.
We definitely can go back for it.
So maybe one day we'll hear about that.
Yes, it's a strong
to your listeners. Stay tuned.
Stay. Ooh, Travis, amazing guys.
Well, Mike claims he has him in the freezer. Right?
Mike says he has him in the freezer. Says Scott. Guys, thank you so much. From the Infamous Indie Podcast, I'm Joe Melillo. Thanks for listening.
Been great.
Awesome. Thank you.
absolute chills, folks. Pure adrenaline. What you heard is the most up-to-date information about John Dillinger and the mystery that surrounds him. More importantly, it was revealed that there is so much more to come. The family is currently working to get their story out there. So if you like what you heard, please share it everywhere with friends, with families, your coworkers, that weird guy on the street, and tell them about this podcast. If you can generate enough interest with me so that the rest of the story could be told, they won't stop the Dillinger family from releasing this information. I've said it before, and I'm saying it again here. I'm so happy to be back. I truly missed producing these podcasts, and I will continue to do the work to bring you the highest quality true content about Indiana. So until the next episode, whenever that may be, maybe next week. This is Joe Melillo. Stay safe, everyone.